Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Well, all right. It's now or never, and welcome back. You know, I'm going to have to say this, and I probably will have to say this for a long time, because we're not at critical mass yet as far as this show. The show is not at a level where there's just that many people, because we haven't been sucked into it that well. But and what I mean by that is that it takes a paradigm shift. There's many people that listen to this show that there's no doubt you've made that paradigm shift where you've pulled yourself away from the pornographic news cycle that is just basically a bunch of entertaining snippets and sound bites that talk about and address and hit the nail on the head with how wrong it is. But nobody, none of these entertainers, no one in the in the porn cycle of news has anything to do with the solution and actually clearly identifying what the root of the problem is. I mean, they'll, you know, how bad we feel because this is happening. And folks, it's one of those things that, you know, everybody knows there's something rotten in Denmark. Everybody smells it, and the smell is so strong we can taste it. And I'm sure that many people have been and have experienced that kind of stench. And fact of the matter is, it ain't going to change. As a matter of fact, as we continue, you know, wrongfully, there's too many parties out there that just basically say, what's it going to take? I mean, you know, you're going to just keep voting for the, you know, because this is what I hear and see the Constitution Party and third parties always say. Libertarian Party says this as well. Well, if you keep voting Democrat and Republican, that's what you're going to get. Well, you have to give them very specific guidance of why voting and getting involved in this process is so uniquely different. Because bottom line, when you look and compare the platforms, when you look and compare what these parties are doing and what they're standing for, there's very little difference. They're just a different spin on the same old thing. No one has put their arms around the problem, and no one has clearly delineated a very straight and narrow path forward that will get rid of all government tyranny. This is why, you know, people don't like it when I poke them in the eye and say, you're no different. I remember sitting down next to, you know, leaders of the Libertarian Party a long time ago. And they said, you know, oh, well, you know, the question I asked them was, how are you different? How are you different? And, oh, well, we have this non-aggression policy and this and this and this and this. And I go, yeah, but, you know, you may have a different spin, but it's just a spin in the same direction. And they kind of looked at me like, huh, what? And as I showed them, they have no plan. I mean, they just want to put their own little spin on unconstitutional government. They're not identifying that all this stuff is unconstitutional. They're not stating that this all has to be dismantled. They don't and didn't understand. If you really understand, then you'll really understand that your platform has to be very succinct and completely aligned with what it takes to get the Constitution, or I should say the federal government, back to the framework of the Constitution, and all governments to be in compliance to it. If you don't care, if that's not your motive in your party, then you'll always live in obscurity as you spiral to your death. Because the two-party system has a monopoly on the whole party. This whole, you know, how can we manage unconstitutional government better? They have a monopoly on it. So if you're going to come along in a party, you're going to come along as an ideologue, you're going to come along and say, we've got something different. Well, you know, talk's cheap, right? We know what walks and we know what talks. And so... what we're basically telling you and what I have been driving at is you must actually make all of the necessary changes. I mean, you cannot have gaps. You can't have, you know, locking points, or I should say rusty spots in your wheels and in your mechanisms. You can't have these things locking up, nor can you afford to allow, you know, big gaps or holes so things can just continually fly through. If you're gonna go fishing, you can't have a bunch of holes in your net. And so bottom line, you have to have full and tight coverage to cover everything you need to catch. And so bottom line, all this stuff that's being done, it's great, but it has to be better. Parties, the IAP, because these are the two parties I've been focused on, the IAP and the Constitution Party, needs to figure out what it takes to get to the very top, to get the top of the high ground, the top of the mountain, on the purity of the Constitution and the purity of a true party in this constitutional republic. In other words, they have to strip away the agendas. They have to strip away, you know, all of these feel-good things and make it all about the Constitution. You know, the Constitution is a compact. It's just like a regular contract for your cell phone service, like a contract for a loan. It is a legal document that legally delineates the roles, responsibilities, powers, and property that the federal government can possess, own, exercise, and do things with. It's jurisdiction. There's no such thing as constitutional law. In other words, when somebody says constitutional law, that's the same thing as saying contract law. That same thing as saying family law, because we've categorized and delineated all these different types of milieus, or these environments where, you know, we have this different functioning law. Contract law is a very specific practice and discipline of law. But constitutional law doesn't exist. It's just like Verizon law, right? Is there such a thing as Verizon law? No. Verizon has contracts, and they basically lay out what you have to do, what they're going to do for you, and so forth. And any party in that contract that violates it, you can go to where? Contract law court, and actually pursue, you know, a tort, or you can pursue a lawsuit because your rights were violated. It's the same thing with the Constitution. It falls under contract court. However, it's not your generic contract court. The court in this case over the U.S. Constitution has a very unique makeup, because the judges and the jury are the states. Because why? Because they are the all-powerful authority over that, and they are the final arbiters, and so only they have that power, and only they can fix these problems. And so understanding this kind of stuff is critical for any party to finally get to that high ground, to finally get up there and put the rocks in the circle and start your fire and basically create a beacon for everybody. Now, there's all sorts of ways and things you can be doing constantly to be sending the message, but you got to get there. You can't be sending a mixed message to say, you know, we're doing this, but you haven't fixed these things. In other words, when people kind of stumble along and they find out that, you know, and this can be done at the state level. This can be done at your county level. As a matter of fact, you may be a part of the Independent American Party, and there may be, you know, a few different county central committees, but your county central committee can be spot on. You can clean it up. You can clean up your bylaws. You have to start at the local level. And the whole point of a party system is from the bottom up. And I'm here to tell you, if you do it right, and you stand up and you articulate, there's not one person that can disagree with you. Those people who do disagree, because there are really people that will disagree. They can't academically disagree. They can't get to the high ground and you know, rain fire upon you. But what they can do is they can come along and they can say, oh, well, so, you know, you're saying this, but, you know, this plank on abortion, there's nothing more important. In other words, they're a denier. They deny your theory and they want to cling to the old paradigm. In other words, they can't adapt and adjust to a greater truth. It's kind of like the Pharisees and the Sadducees when they asked Christ, you know, what is the greatest commandment? And Christ basically put them into, you know, two commandments. I mean, that had to have blown their mind. There was nothing they could say or do because he was right. He was on the high ground. And every time they came after him, it's the same thing with our party system, folks. If you're not on the high ground, we're not there yet. We've got great movement, and we've got, you know, movements in the right directions. But we got to get there, because once you're on the high ground, now you have, you know, an impenetrable argument. Either people will just deny you, and they'll scoff, and they will make their, you know, their unsupported assertions, or they'll either walk away, or they'll come on board. And bottom line is, if they're smart and they really care, they will come on board. But the problem is, people have to start giving up their self-interest. People have to start giving up what makes them different and start uniting on the Constitution. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so why is GR going, you know, I'm not actually trying to go for or strangle, cut the jugulars on any party or anything else. Bottom line, we have to be honest, we have to be forthright, and we have to do what's necessary. At least you can count on me to do that. You can count on me to not bite my tongue and say, this is wrong. And the only way this is going to get fixed, the only way things are going to get better, is by us making the necessary changes to actually make things better. So, with that, I also want to kind of remind you that this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org, and you're listening to the only show that goes through the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions, which is why we've been covering the Constitution from the preamble to the 28th Amendment. Yeah, there's 27 that you know of, but there's actually 28, and we're going to get into all 28 amendments. We've actually covered, if I remember correctly, we just covered the original First Amendment, not the First Amendment you're familiar with, but I'm covering a couple of amendments that were a part of the Bill of Rights, because I think it's important that we understand. And when we're all done with this, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you kind of a highlight of the petitions, how many petitions we've come up with as we've gone through. Now, remember earlier this year, I laid out a comprehensive list of issues and matters that were necessary for campaigning, what I called the Bill of Rights for 2022 or the 21st century. And so in that, we came up with 85 petitions as I looked at what was going on. And what I mean by that is things that are occurring because the federal government just doesn't have these authorities. Now, I'm actually going through the Constitution and finding with all of the violations against the Constitution by the federal government and by the states, I'm identifying petitions in addition to that. So I can tell you right now, we're well over 100, and as one sits back, I mean, we could consume our life as we watch the final stages of decay of this republic come to its fruition. In other words, we can sit here and watch this basic hybrid constitution, this the greatest nation ever created, this hybrid constitutional republic, actually decay to a point where it just basically crumbles underneath our feet, where we fall. We're almost there. I keep on telling you, we're at the precipice, you know, and the poking of the dagger, the sword that's driving us off this plank, off this precipice, is, you know, hurting, and we're trying not to. I mean, let me ask you this. If you're really standing on a cliff and you know that if you fall, you're going to die, well, then why not make that person just finish the job first by actually, you know, poking you and killing you with the sword? I mean, would it not be better to force that person to take your life than to have them coerce you into taking your own? I mean, this is what we're doing. We're better off standing our ground, turning around, taking that little bit. And I'm telling you, folks, I can't tell you enough how the Lord and the power of the Lord, the power he possesses, can overwhelm and vanquish our enemies. All we need is faith. Execute the faith in doing those things that the Constitution demands. And I will tell you that you will win these battles. And so, all things being his will, but there's no doubt in my mind, it is his will that we preserve liberty. It is his will that we take a stand, we fight for ourselves. And he, just like he did throughout the history of mankind, he will bless us. He will give us the victories and what have yous. But anyway, what we're doing is we're going through the Constitution. I'm going through the Bill of Rights, and actually I'm going through the original text of the Bill of Rights that was submitted by Congress. Now, what I did was we kind of covered the preamble because we kind of wrapped it up at the very end of the last segment. So I covered the preamble, and I need to go over this amendment so that you understand the importance of this amendment. What kind of government do we have? Now, most people will say, oh, well, we have a democracy. There's lots of people out there that will say, no, we have a Republican form of government. And that is true. And that is a basic layer. It's a basic plane of the type of government that we have. This First Amendment that was in the Bill of Rights secures our representation. It doesn't secure us, because if you look at a Republican form of government, there's two key factors. Now, one factor is our representation, so that we absolutely and truly have a representative. See, the larger you move your representation to represent a larger group of people, you move away from a Republican form of government and you move towards a Democratic form of government. Well, hold on here. How is that? Because as you start including more and more people, your representative becomes far less sensitive to the uniquenesses of a smaller group of people. And I'll give you a good case in point, because, and we cover this quite a bit, but if you look at every state has its unique needs, it has its own unique labor, productivity. I mean, each state brings something different. Each state brings something different. You know, California brings the fruits and nuts, right? And so when we look at Iowa, the Iowa brings the corn. And when we look at Wyoming, Wyoming brings, you know, cattle and or coal and, you know, these different types of products. So when we look at the interest, even within a state, we start recognizing that even though a state may have a high propensity of producing, let's just say, and here's a good example, is a coastal state where all of the counties along the coastline, their focus is either commerce, you know, the shipping coming and going, the fishing, and things that are of that coast. The further away from you get from that coast, the less important that coast is in your everyday life. Because you may be a farmer, you may be doing other things to support yourself. You live on the coast, you're probably a fisherman. You live on the coast, you probably, or at least you're doing something that has a reason to, for keeping you there or putting you there. Now, doesn't mean you can't be a trucker, because, you know, truckers pick up the goods that come in from the ports and ship that into the interior, what have you. But the being on the coast creates a lot of commerce and creates a lot of significance from that coastline. Now, you start moving inland. Now, it becomes agricultural. It becomes timber. It becomes different facets of different interest within that state. Now, if you, because if you look at the layout, just grab any state that has a coastline. And especially the bigger the state is, the better you can see this. Because like Massachusetts, they're so close to the coastline and they're so just densely populated that Massachusetts, there's not a lot of room there. Now, here we go looking at like Virginia or the Carolinas. The hub of activity, commerce, and everything else on that coastline starts shifting away as you start going into the interior. Some of it may be river traffic, river commerce, because there are some large major rivers that have either boats or what have you that move things downriver to the port. I mean, in the old days, you know, having commerce travel down these calm rivers on the East Coast or even the West Coast, like Portland and the Columbia River, that was a common way of moving commerce, because it was easier to use a ship than it was to actually put all of that commerce on a whole bunch of wagons and take that wagon all the way out to the ocean. So they start using rivers. They started using waterways. They started creating canals. I mean, waterway and water traffic was so important that that's why they started having these Erie canals and the building of highways and waterways, because they could move commerce a lot easier a lot easier doing it on water. I mean, the majority of all the shipping, if you look at how much commerce we ship on a ship, you can't even do that on a rail. I mean, these railroad car chains would be, you know, it's so immense. When you look at some of these cargo ships, they just can't do that. Plus, the whole beauty of the transshipment points is that many of those containers don't go all in the same direction. They actually disperse. Some go across the north to the center and so forth. So anyway, forgive me for getting into the rats here or the weeds in this rat hole. But the fact of the matter is that as you start moving towards the mountains, towards the timber, your focus literally changes, and your needs that need to be addressed are equally as equal as those people on the coast. So how is this so important, and why is this amendment so important? We'll be right back after these two promos.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as I kind of tell you and kind of have dissected the inner interests and the differences between literally the people that live in one part of the same county as another part, then you'll start finding that your representation at your state level and even at the federal level is a lot different, which is why when we start really holding them accountable to, because at the federal level, there's very little things that your representative really can do for you. The only time you actually should be going to your representative in Congress is over those things that are enumerated. In other words, your taxes. In other words, the war. You know, if they've got a war that they want to put you into, you know, is that a good thing? Are we meddling? What the heck are we doing? We've allowed them to take on so many things that they have no business meddling in that we have forgotten the big things and the major things to say, hey, we've been so distracted in holding them accountable that over the past century, they've been able to manipulate warfare and get their nose into businesses of other countries that they have no constitutional power to do so. They do have the power to declare war. but the reasons why and the how they justify it to us is absolutely wrong. And so I go over this all the time. But when we look at the state, I mean, because these men that created this Constitution, as I told you, when they were walking into signing the Constitution, they made one final change out of a couple of little changes for the style committee to address. And that one change was to take it from 40,000 people of representatives. In other words, one representative could only represent 40,000 people, no more. And so what they did was they took that and they reduced it to 30,000, feeling that 30,000 was a better representative. The only reason it was at 40,000 was Madison was aware of the fact that as population grows, that they would need to, you know, to kind of grow that representation a little bit. But the argument was, how can one person represent 40,000 people, you know, when 30,000 people is, you know, it's still a lot of people for one person to know and represent? They're supposed to know you. They need to understand what you're going through. And the bigger of the area, the more complex they make it for them to understand, the harder it is for them to really understand you. The only thing that they start caring about are those big things. Oh, you know, more people care about what's going on your coastline than anything else. I've told you this before. The majority of the people in your state, the closer you get to the coast, the more dense population gets. The further away from the coast, the more rural population gets. Isn't that interesting? Now, you may have hubs and points where you still have large cities, Chicago, Indianapolis, and so forth. But those are driven by either state commerce. They become big, you know, like Denver. How did Denver get to be so big in the middle of nowhere? Very easy, folks. When all those people that were going to the California coast to make gold, or for whatever reason was compelling them to go across, to go west, to the west coast, when people came across those plains and they got at the foot of the Rocky Mountains, they looked at those mountains and they, you know, started hearing the stories of what it took to go across those mountains and how big and thick, how wide that mountain range was. Denver was made by quitters. I just want to be clear here. I know a lot of people from Denver, Colorado, they hate it when they hear this, but it is a quitter city because the people that went there had no intention of just, I wanted to go to Denver and live in Denver when Denver was being established. Denver had hardly any water. I mean, they had some water, but I mean, it's been a dry and barren area. To make it productive, it was very difficult. And as you look, that, you know, their local production of food and so forth. I mean, Nebraska, yeah, Kansas, yeah, the wheat baskets and so forth. But most of the people at that point in time that created the city of Denver, Denver started growing because more and more people that were coming across thinking they could make it to the West Coast ended up quitting. And it was the last point to go, you know what, I'm not going to make it across that. So this, I'd rather survive. I'd rather quit and survive and stay here. And going back across the plains, back to where they came from, that was a lot of effort back in those days, folks, just to do that. So when we look at how cities, you know, come to be, there are interesting reasons and interesting points, but the fact of the matter is, when you start looking at the interest and representation, the design by the framers, and we kind of covered this in the ratification debates, but they do go into detail on this, that the design of this Constitution was to make sure that population centers, that mob rule could not actually invoke tyranny of the majority on the minority. But that's what we're seeing today. And the reason that is because of representation. Now, let's look at it. Let's look at 30,000 people. That was based on the Constitution. 30,000 people in representation when you look at your city, I mean, San Diego was, I think, just a little over a million people about 10, 15 years ago. It's probably doubled that by now. But just using that as an example, San Diego would have Congress people or congressmen that would amount to, I mean, that's a lot of congressmen, right? There would be 10 for every 300,000. So we're talking, that would be 30-some, you know, I'm not going to do the math in my head. It's over 30 representatives in Congress. When we start really looking at, can you break down San Diego, or can you break down your city into areas or communities or boroughs that where you would actually have a disparate interest? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look at Harlem. Look at Brooklyn. Look at Queens. And just in New York, all of these different cities, even in a population center, some of these parts aren't a part of that hub or that commerce on the coast. They have completely different interests. You know, Manhattan, you know, or the financial district or the theater district or what have you. The point is that the purity of a representative form of government, the only way we can guard it is by creating a cap on limitations of representation. You know, most people think you got too many legislators involved. Well, hold on here. The way our system was designed is the House's job, the House's focus was on those big things that would affect the people, such as war, such as taxation. But all the other stuff, you know, the laws, and if you look at how they delineate the roles, responsibilities, and powers between the Senate and the House of Representatives, it wasn't that hard because, in all honesty, the majority, because they were so limited in the powers that they had, these men were able to actually have regular jobs because they weren't representing that much in government. There may be very few people that they represented, but they weren't representatives that could plug into every facet of your life. They're not supposed to. They're limited to the enumerated roles, responsibilities, powers, and property. And that's it, folks. And so we didn't need to have a whole bunch of people to be represented by one. We don't need government to be that involved in our lives. This was a perfect and beautiful system. And the corruption and the sleight of hand that they've used and the slow migration of shifting powers from your local community into centralized state and federal governments, folks, this is where we've all been, well, we've been screwed. They've been, you know, taking advantage, and they've been assuming the powers to a point where they can reign and level us with tyranny. So that's why this one amendment is so important. There is only one argument that people are trying to make. Oh, it makes government too big. You know, when you actually give that much representation for Congress, for the House of Representatives, then my question is, why is it? Because they don't have that much to do. Why is it? Because you can't put everybody on committees, right? I mean, you only got these certain committees that are constitutional. Most all the committees will go away, right? So what is it that really demands that they have 20 to 40 assistants and staff? Why is it that they're employing so many people? Because they're doing all sorts of things that they have no business doing. You want to shrink the size of government? Pass this amendment and bring all of your representatives home, and we will unemploy the majority of the bureaucrats and the majority of the parasites that are residing in D.C. Wow. So it's just dawned on me that we really haven't covered anything. I've just kind of monologued or editorialized and or griped a little bit here about, you know, this, that of the Constitution, parties, and so forth. When we come back, we're going to actually read the second amendment that is in the original Bill of Rights, and from there, we'll be right back after this.
Do To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so the second article, remember what they did was they wrote these things in articles. And so the second article, or second proposed amendment, was this. No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. Now, one of the things that I want you to notice here is they have this compensation for services. In other words, it's basically paying your salary. It's a salary. Nowhere in here did they allow Congress to create incentives, to create retirement. That is absolutely unacceptable. So here's my point. If you really want to clean up Congress, for those people who are, because there's no reason why we can't have great, honorable men serving this country for their entire life, if that's what they so choose. But it cannot be, it has to be based on sacrifice. It cannot be based on, you know, golden parachutes and this opulence and this level of being above the law where you can walk, you can inject millions into your personal account like what we're seeing today. That is repugnant to public service. And so what you see in the Constitution, what you see in this particular amendment is that they don't have the ability to create their own retirements, to basically aggrandize themselves. And right here is the evidence that clarifies that they can't be giving themselves anything until after the next election. Because why? When you find out that they're giving themselves something, then you can actually say something about that and actually campaign against it and say, I'm going to take office and we've got this new movement and we're all going to go into office to undo this pay raise that they've given themselves. We don't need them to be making an outrageous amount of money. It's one thing that they have a decent pay, that they can survive and, you know, pay for their fundamental needs and so forth, but they shouldn't be getting rich off of the public. So This is where we actually have to sit down, and the states need to sit down and say, what is a fair compensation? Oh, but folks, in doing so, the states need to come up with their own fair compensation, because I'm one to tell you that when it comes to state legislators, they are underpaid. They're underpaid with what they're supposed to be doing, and they're running ragged because they don't even have the time with the way they compress everything. These guys are the ones that should be working full time, like your county commissioners, or almost like your county commissioners. And so, I mean, we need to grow government at the county level. We need to shrink it kind of somewhat at the state level, somewhat. But compensation needs to be fixed. There's a real problem when your state legislators are making less than, you know, even a, what do you want to call it, a paralegal secretary. So, folks, when you look at what paralegals bring in and what you, you know, people that work in law, these guys are making laws. These guys are, you know, guarding and arguing whether these laws should go into effect or not. And, you know, so in comparison, I mean, the top attorney general and the top lawmakers and judges, I mean, these guys are the ones that have to argue, you know, the merits of these laws or defend these laws. And so are you kidding me? You can't tell me that your Congress, or I should say your state legislators, are receiving a just and fair compensation for what they are really doing. But we need to change their focus, and we need to make sure that they're, you know, they're doing actually things that they should be doing, because there's lots of stuff that they're doing because they're being told that they need to do it by the federal government and other entities that are unconstitutional that they shouldn't even be listening to. So anyway, that right there, I believe, is the 27th Amendment. We'll cover it again when we go through them, but I wanted to point out that, wow, here is an amendment that's not in the Bill of Rights, but it actually did get ratified. None of these amendments were time-dated. They weren't constrained by a specific expiration date. They didn't expire. So this first amendment that we've gone through in adjusting representation from 30 to 40 to 50,000, capping at 50,000, that amendment can still be ratified. That's why if you want to drain, or actually if you want to displace the swamp, get rid of the swamp altogether, not just drain it, but displace it so that the swamp can't be created again, pass this amendment. Get your representatives to actually extend themselves back home and no longer be working in the D.C. swamp. Anyway, the Third Amendment, and this is actually in you know, today's speak, this is actually the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, I want to be clear here that there is a dovetailing in this final inalienable right. Why would the people assemble? Why would they need to peaceably assemble? Why the words peaceably? Because one, this was a civil society that these men were creating, and they knew it would go hand in hand that when the people got upset and riled, the reason why people actually, you know, get upset and take to the streets is because they're not happy with what's going on with their government. Or they're trying to overthrow their government or trying to overthrow paradigms, existing paradigms. That's why when you look at civil unrest, it's never, you know, usually about the, you know, the quality of the milk or, you know, too many pillows or, you know, it's always about government, taxation. So the reason why, if you look through the history, like in labor unions would actually organize against the company or against the corporation that they feel they're being sided with. Well, so that in itself is not protected within this Constitution. You have to peaceably assemble. And when labor unions actually, you know, create walls or what have you, they cannot block the entranceways. Just like when you peaceably assemble, you cannot block the entranceway of the now you have a right to go into the Capitol, but you can't just clog it. So, I mean, they can come along and say, okay, hold on here. We still need to function, so we're going to have to keep most of you outside, and you can stay over here. And when people come out, you can come back in. And that's how you can do it. But this is why when you organize something like January 6th, you need to have a group of leaders that have the petition who can articulate and add to the argument in this petition that the federal government and Congress needed to reject the Electoral College and all the things that should have transpired on January 6th. So with that, I want you to understand that there are a couple of other things in this amendment that need to be really help clarified, because we understand when we get to the 14th Amendment, we know that all of the protections, the privileges and immunities that are guaranteed in this Constitution are basically applied to the states, so that the states cannot deny you privileges and immunities. So when we look at this, let me ask you this. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Now, is that something that would be a privilege, or is this something that could be applied to your state? In other words, can your state establish a religion? Because if they do, would that be denying or abridging your privileges and your immunities? No, it won't. Technically, states can and actually have, and after the 14th Amendment, there were still some of the 13, I think it was three of the 13 original states, still had state-sponsored churches in the 1860s. Yeah, that's right, three. Plus, there were new states that came into the Union that had state-sponsored churches as well. So, in other words, secularism and this moving away from, you know, this symbiotic relationship at the state level with a state-sponsored church wasn't, you know, the godlessness hadn't, you know, fully taken effect yet. There were still states that had this relationship with a church. So the question is, why is it that the progressives don't like this and they have tried to enforce the establishment of religion upon churches? Or, I mean, the establishment of religion upon a state. If they have an establishment of a religion where they deny you your privilege and immunity of the freedom of speech and or the exercise of religion, then yes, they are violating your civil rights. But when we look at this, the establishment of religion, that doesn't mean that they're abridging your privileges and immunities. You have to actually prove how this establishment or this relationship with this religion has actually stepped on and abridged your privileges or immunities. If it doesn't, then go home. We'll pick this back up tomorrow because it's that important. We'll be right back tomorrow. Same bad channel, same bad time. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.